Well, since I always seem to have too much material, okay, we'll start. Okay, so I'm going to begin with a prayer that I committed to memory, but I'm not sure I'm remembering it exactly correctly. But it's by a man who was very important in the 16th century, Ustakus, figure or Jesuit, who has a really nice collection of prayers called Your Word is Near. And so let's pray. You nourish and sustain the world from day to day, and wherever we go, you are more present than we dare presume. We believe in this presence, this faithful, vulnerable presence here and now, as we live from bread, as we live from you, as we hunger and thirst for peace. So I like that prayer for all sorts of reasons, but the idea of vulnerability is something that's going to be coming up in today's examination of the thought of Elizabeth Johnson, a really important theologian internationally, an important Catholic theologian, an important feminist theologian, who's written somewhere between 8 and 10 books. The one that I'm drawing on, that I'm presenting to you about, is called She Who Is, The Mystery of God in Feminist Theological Discourse. She wrote a more popular book that's thinner, called I think Spirit of the Living God or something, which actually was censured, unfortunately, in the last couple of years by a kind of council of bishops. But she's been a very important figure. She teaches at Fordham University. She's, for me, one of the kind of most vital and rich and creative intellectuals kind of on the theological scene in the last few decades. She has a book on Mary, on the communion of saints, on Jesus. She has all sorts of books on different doctrines within a system of theology. So I'll just start. I'm not going to frame as much today because, again, I've been kind of going over. I'm just going to get right into her thought. But I did think that a quotation from her from the beginning of this book might be a nice entry point to the themes, to her work in general that we're going to be talking about today, but also the larger themes of the series that I've been offering this week. Okay, so Johnson's theological project in this book on how to talk about God. She says, "My aim in what follows is to speak a good word about the mystery of God, recognizable within the contours of the Christian faith, that will serve the emancipatory praxis of all of women and men to the benefit of all creation, both human beings and the earth." Not a small task. So some things that I think are noteworthy about this quotation that point to important principles in her thought. So first she says, "My aim in what follows is to speak a good word." Johnson certainly is the kind of theologian for whom it's important to emphasize the mystery of God, the incomprehensibility of God, the ways in which God and God's self always transcends our language for God. And she, in one part of her book, in a very moving way, paraphrases the work of Martin Buber, the Jewish theologian, in some of his post-Holocaust writings, in which he says, "The dilemma of the word God itself, however, is a real one and not easily resolved. Its effective history has been brutal as well as blessed." Okay. So really pointing to the ways in which God talk can oppress, can harm, can be brutal, can be valorizing of certain notions of power and used for ideological purposes, and also has possibilities that are transformative and redemptive and can disrupt in a positive way unjust situations and be important tools and important expressions of the lives and needs and hopes of different communities. And so she also would agree that this next word that sticks out for me is about the mystery of God. So she certainly believes that our experience is something, i.e. God, who is never directly available, but is always mediated through particular experience. Okay. So there is a way in which that mystery is always preserved. And she is deeply influenced by all sorts of philosophical movements, theologians, cultural movements, different modes of thought. One being the thought of Karl Rahner, important 20th century Catholic theologian, And she really draws on his theological anthropology, or his conception of what it is to be human. And that emphasizes that we are dynamically structured toward mystery. Mystery as a source and support and goal. And this mystery is something that dynamically calls us in loving ways toward us. And as we're called more closely to mystery, the mystery doesn't go away, it actually deepens even more, but also brings us into more loving dimensions of what it is to be human. So this is part of her orientation. So within the contours of Christian faith, so she's deeply rooted in tradition, and I'll tell you about her sources and authority that she draws on for her theology. But she's got a liberationist bent to her project. So as we talked about a couple days ago with James Cone, she wants to serve the liberatory or the emancipatory praxis, the practice of women and men working for liberation to the benefit of creation and all human beings on the earth. So I think this is a nice entry point into her project that we're going to be looking at today. So I'm going to give you a little bit of a broad overview of some of the sort of central points of her work, but then I want to focus on the way that she's trying to reimagine God's power and God's nature in some sense. Okay, so this is going to be quick, but that's because it's not really the crux of what I'm saying. It's more a background, so you know something about her project. So the sources that Johnson draws upon that she finds authoritative for her work as a constructive theologian are as follows. She roots herself firmly within a feminist liberation perspective, and so she affirms that religious mystery, in other words, a God, who she believes makes an a priori option for the human flourishing of women and men. She says of an aspect and saying women here. So, but does make an a priori option for the human flourishing of women, and she qualifies this to mean the most underprivileged and marginalized women and other communities that are also suffering in certain forms of injustice. Okay, so a priori, that which comes before. So before everything else, there's an option for the human flourishing of women and all people, that's how she often says it. She draws extensively on classical theology, which refers to the theology of the early church fathers, deeply influenced by the early years of the tradition, but also with strong influences from Greek philosophy. And so she both stands in critical relationship to classical theology, but really, very impressively appropriates moves that she thinks are really important resources for feminist theology within the classical tradition. So what's she critical of? With respect to God talk, which is what we're focusing on today, she is critical of the ways in which the tradition has used exclusively male language for God. Not just male language, but exclusively male language. The ways in which not using male language is basically heresy, technically, unless it's perhaps kind of abstract language, right? But female language is deemed to be heretical and certainly out of order, but also an imagery that's hierarchical, that construes, for example, the relations among the Trinitarian persons as hierarchical. Even though within the tradition that was ruled out in the early years of the formation of Trinitarian doctrine as a heresy called monarchialism, where God is construed as a monarch, where the Father is above the Son, right? That the true relation among the Trinitarian persons is meant to be relational, right? But she thinks the tradition forgets this and slips into a hierarchical conception of God and God's power in the Trinitarian relationship. So she's critical of that exclusively male language and hierarchical language for God because she thinks it's both idolatrous and oppressive. Why would she think it's idolatrous? Anyone have any thoughts about that? Anything come to mind? I mean, oppressive, I think, is not, you know, if she's a feminist theologian, she might think that hierarchical male language is oppressive. That doesn't seem to be hard to grasp. But why is it idolatrous? Anyone have any? There's not one answer in my head, but think out loud about this. Yeah?
Is it putting the human male hierarchy into the place of God so it's God is an image mm-hmm. of the way some people imagine our human structure should be ideally, that the man, the father figure would be the...
Okay. Good. Yeah, well said. Sonia, did you want to answer to that?
Well, sort of the same idea, but that the male God language is so limiting to mm-hmm. who and what God actually is that we actually have replaced God or limited God's perspective.
It takes male language and elevates it. So something finite is elevated to the infinite, which is one definition of idolatry, to take something human as God. So that male experience and male language is elevated to the status of that which is only appropriately God. And therefore, that's an act of idolatry. Okay. But she also wants to appropriate the tradition. And this is why I'm always so puzzled that her work was censured, because she's so deeply influenced by Aquinas, by obviously by scripture, by early church fathers, etc. So she certainly appropriates what she sees as a central tenet and valuable tenet of early classical theology influenced by Greek metaphysics, namely divine incomprehensibility. So in Greek thought, there's an idea that that originate source that is beyond, that is behind and the source of all that is itself not directly knowable. And so the idea that God and God's self is unknowable or is incomprehensible, she thinks is a wonderful resource, precisely because it's a corrective to those who would say that only male language is appropriate for God. Okay, well, what happened to divine incomprehensibility, right, if people think that only male language is appropriate for God? Okay, so she also then draws on monastic practices of negation or negative theology, which tries to see the limitations of any work to capture God. But so one first affirms something of God, so God is a loving father, but then one negates the ways in which God is not like a human father, because God is mysteriously more than a human father, and whatever father would mean or love would mean when applied to God has to be different than what it means when we apply it to humans. And yet then when one then, after meditating on the way in which our language doesn't capture God, we then reassert that language, but in a new eminent way. We apply it in a mode of eminence, so that whatever way God is loving or like a father, it's eminently more and perfect and other than what we would imagine, yet still appropriate when speaking of God. So it's kind of a tool for both being able to say something about God, or else we're left with nothing, right? But yet reminding ourselves and meditating on the ways in which our language never captures God, and that God is always more than our language. Okay. And so then she also draws on traditions she finds in which, therefore, there's a call for analogies for God drawn from the variety of experience or the diversity of creation. So there's a need for many names for God. So if we need to kind of, we need to both affirm and then negate, but then reassert many names for God drawn from the variety that we see in creation. Okay, so all of these can be symbolically appropriate for God as long as we remember that they don't completely capture God. And then we will see that she really, this book is kind of a reimagination of the Trinitarian persons. So she draws on the classical doctrine of the Trinity as the model of God's nature, and specifically Trinitarian model of God emphasizing the interrelationality of God, which she thinks then helps her think about God's power or God's nature as mutual, which is a different image of God's power than a hierarchical kind of power. Okay. So, she also draws on scripture, which she sees as androcentric, so modeled on a male experience because of its kind of historical and cultural origin, etc. And she doesn't find it as just simply intrinsically authoritative, just in a simplistic sort of direct sort of way. Certainly she finds it authoritative. But she, it has to be interpreted, and she follows Vatican II on this, for the sake of our salvation. So scripture is authoritative when it's interpreted in ways that affirm and promote our salvation, when it's used in those appropriate kinds of ways. And then she makes an effort to search for female symbols that she thinks are hidden and present within Old and New Testament. So the model that she then comes up with for God of the language is the notion of Sophia, or holy wisdom, which we've encountered in some of the different sessions this week, or Bible studies as well. So the idea of God is Sophia God, Sophia Jesus, and Sophia Spirit, the wisdom that animates and is the source of creation, and that draws us to just and compassionate relationships. She sees tradition as a source for theology. She thinks it's an ambivalent source. It has both assets to draw on. It has deficits, because it's also been it's been a source of unjust power. It has generated theological ideas and different kinds of practices that she thinks are harmful. There are mixed messages, but it's also internally diverse, so there's a lot that we can do with it. Okay. And then she thinks women's experience is an important source for theology, and specifically experiences of suffering, but also experiences of empowerment and vitality, a notion of relationship as mutual or mutuality, and the idea that women are created in the image of God. I know I'm talking really fast, but this is all just kind of background. here, so to give you a sense of kind of the breadth of sources that she draws upon as she starts to reconstruct this language for God. Okay, she acknowledges, by the way, that this is problematic because not all women are the same, right? So she doesn't think that all women have the same kind of experiences, but she thinks that because of the positionality of women in most places, there is a common experience often of some kinds of suffering, and there is also a common experience of certain kinds of empowerment. But she knows that this can be tricky business when we start affirming that sort of all women have the same kinds of experiences, but she doesn't want to say. Okay, so the task of theology then is to first approach these sources and deconstruct them. So bring a critical eye to scripture, tradition, classical theology, inherited models of God that she finds problematic, right? But then go back to the tradition and retrieve symbols in new ways, sources and ideas in new ways, and then reconstruct those symbols, and directed by this, what she calls lens of women's flourishing. So this is the criterion she's going to use that helps her shape her retrieval of sources in the tradition. And according to what criteria? She, again, as a liberationist theologian, is very important that she wants to, or liberation theologian, she wants to affirm that any theology has to kind of pass the test of affirming the well-being of underprivileged women. Okay. So she says, she has this quotation, "Justice toward women and right speaking about God are inseparable." Justice toward women and right speaking about God are inseparable. Take a moment and chat about that with your neighbor, what you see in that quotation, how you think it fits together. So keep yourself, your mind awake and your thoughts flowing while I'm lecturing here. Justice toward women and right speaking about God are inseparable. Is that true? Is it always true, what you see in it? So, does this quotation speak to you? What do you see in this quotation? Let's have a couple of people sharing their reactions and we'll keep moving. What does this say to you? Does it seem right? What kind of response does it evoke from you personally, or what do you see it saying? Those kinds of questions. Does it seem right? Justice for women and right speaking about God are inseparable.
I reacted to the toward women because I think you could probably say toward the oppressed.
Mm-hmm.
And having worked with children and how voiceless and powerless children often are in many cultures and many situations, I think that ought to be part of saying that. That includes almost mm-hmm. intrinsically women.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, now I'll react to that comment, which mm-hmm. is that when we take women and put them into a category which is inclusive of lots of other things, you don't pay the same kind of attention to the uniqueness that women experience within whatever society or situation you're looking at, including the discussion about where women are in the context of theology and how we look at God and the hierarchy that's male over female, etc. I don't disagree with you.
Likewise. Yeah, those are really nice points. And I think this is something in her work that she, first of all, as a liberationist theologian, she doesn't want to take kind of the view from nowhere, and she doesn't want to claim that her theology addresses all possible situations. She's really making a strategic decision to address a specific kind of injustice. So she's not saying this is the most important injustice, this is the only injustice, right? And I think she would say that, yeah, there's a place to honor this kind of focal point and not also bring in other concerns, even though she wants to kind of, you know, ultimately gesture toward those as equally valid somehow.
But again, to dilute it.
What?
Not to dilute
it. Yeah, not to dilute it and to kind of give it its time and its place, especially since, and so she ultimately will say that she thinks that male language for God is appropriate, because if she really respects divine incomprehensibility, and if she has this accusation of idolatry toward exclusively male language, she's certainly not going to claim exclusively female language. But she does think that it would be nice if there were a time when one prioritized for a while, you know, for a certain amount of time. What if one were to prioritize female language for God to the exclusion of male language, just to see how that feels and see how that serves as a corrective within the church for conceptions of God. Yeah.
Both a correction, corrective, and also an opening. I mean,
good,
it
yeah.
It's the mystery again, constantly reopening. I'm not sure my comment would be resonant with what your expanded exposition of that sentence is, but I would think you could also phrase it kind of rightly, speaking about God will have justice and so on. And if you look at
okay.
the result of your speech
yeah.
and it doesn't do that,
good.
Then you've spoken falsely.
Okay.
So that all that enterprise about this is for others uh-huh. rather than kind of a ratification of your position.
Yes.
Whatever that might be.
Good. Yeah, and that kind of harkens back to her criterion of kind of the women's flourishing as kind of the lens. So if you take something and say, well, when you're speaking this way, what are the implications?
Does
if you're speaking rightly,
yeah.
it will promote flourishing. If you're speaking wrongly, it won't promote flourishing.
And putting it that way also, you don't start, I'm looking for flourishing stuff. Then you,
right.
then it's a kind of
good.
Instrumentality. So it's
right.
more looking at the consequences.
Yep.
You have to pay attention to the consequences.
Right, the power of language. Yeah. Yeah, excellent. Good, thank you. So, in addition, she wants to always respect divine incomprehensibility, and that will be a theme that echoes throughout her work. And then to also focus on, again, this notion of the relationality of the Trinitarian persons as an entry point for a critique of certain models of power that she thinks have been imported into the concept God. Okay. So, one more setup slide, which doesn't take as much, but I want to give you a little, in case you're curious. You. So what I'm not going to focus on the different ways she wants to symbolize God. I'm actually going to focus on how she models God's power. But she does, a big section of the book is on reimagining through scripture and tradition and women's experience what it would mean to call God Mother Sophia, right? Jesus Sophia, and Spirit Sophia. Okay, and so she comes up with new language for God that one can try out. But a couple of you have made reference to the potentially problematic kind of nature or of saying that of speaking just about women in general. Okay, so she does want to avoid the idea again that all women are the same, even though she acknowledges that women can fruitfully join in solidarity to address issues that often do affect women uniquely. So there have been different options put forward by feminist theologians for how to reimagine language for God in female terms. Okay. And so one option is feminine traits. Look for feminine traits and apply them to God. Okay. So that would be to say, well, what do we associate with femininity versus masculinity, and how can we then use those feminine traits and apply them to God? Okay. Another one is to say, well, to look for feminine dimensions of God. Say, and sometimes this has been done easily with the Spirit. The Holy Spirit has been the one who seemed to be sort of the feminine face of the Trinity. It's hard to think of Father and Son as feminine, right? And when one's, but she's not happy with these options, these first two. What about you? Are you unhappy with them, or what do you think about feminine traits? Do you have a sense of why she would be unhappy with feminine traits or feminine dimensions?
First of all, you're labeling things as feminine or masculine instead
good.
Of human.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Good.
Like nurturing, and say nurturing is feminine when fathers could be
right.
nurturing as well.
Okay.
So it's stereotypes.
It draws on gender stereotypes. Is that
what? Well, that's what I was going to say. If those traits come out of our cultures so much,
mm-hmm.
what are really are the traits and what are the culture making?
Good.
It's so slippery.
Yeah.
And trivial.
Uh-huh.
Jesus had long hair.
I see the picture.
Yeah, I like it's I think there's a couple things that came up in the statements. One is that it kind of valorizes stereotypes, right? Or it draws on stereotypes in simplistic ways. But I think that you said something in addition to that, which is that these stereotypes are predicated on kind of notions of inequality, right? Men, sort of, I mean, classically, we can even think in a lot of classical Christian theology, the idea of maleness is closer to rationality, closer, more appropriately authoritative, more appropriately strong, et cetera, and femaleness is as really, in, for example, in certain moments of the thought of Aquinas, is kind of an inferior male, right? So female traits like weakness or compassion or suffering or relationality, that just sort of reinforces gender hierarchy, right? And basically it reinforces patriarchy, is what she would say, right? By keeping these stereotypes in place, it both trivializes who people are, but it also keeps that patriarchal kind of motive kind of power and societal structure kind of in place as well. So she tries to say that she wants to use equivalent images, and what I probably should have written, which makes it clearer, because this would take too long to explain. She wants to use female language. Now you might think, well, what's the difference? And she's like, well, I know it's not that much of a difference, but I just don't want to use this word feminine because it's just so problematic. I don't want feminine traits or feminine dimensions, but I want to use female language for God, okay? So by that she means she wants to think about how could we think of God as female, but drawing on a whole range of emotions and capacities. So for example, she often thinks of the image of the ferocious anger of a mother bear protecting her cubs, a female image, right? But that departs from this masculine-feminine dichotomy somehow, right? So she wants to kind of associate female names and female capacities, but not in ways that collapse into just femininity as it's stereotypically been construed. Okay. So that's her approach. She doesn't want the feminine stuff. She wants female names, and she means something significant by that. I'm going to keep going because that's not exactly our focus, but just a little clue about what she does with these Trinitarian symbols. So even then with Jesus, for example, it's Jesus Sophia, and so she thinks of Jesus in female ways, but without kind of negating Jesus' identity, but still thinking of how it can conform to and highlight certain aspects of women's experience.
Can you just give us an example or two real quick of how she would think of Jesus in a female way? What language that would be?
Yeah.
I mean, I hear those words, but
yeah.
My image is, I'm not sure.
Well, I mean, here, I can't think of one that, one might be thinking about, the only ones I can think of are things that we sometimes do associate with femininity, like, you know, compassion and suffering with, and et cetera, and self, but a certain kind of prophetic solidarity. I have to remind myself a bit. I can look in the middle of the chapter. That was just refreshing my memory about the end of the chapter, the end part of the book that we're going to be focusing on. But she certainly draws on the ways in which, or she reminds us of the ways in which Jesus is sort of Sophia's child in some sense, and so thinks of Jesus in that as a sort of coming from a female mother in that sense, and sort of the language for Jesus as logos being similar to the language of Jesus as wisdom, who's construed as feminine in the Old Testament. But I'll get back to that if I can think of some examples. At the moment, my memory's not serving me well. So we're going to talk next about power. So along with these new names for God that she wants to encourage communities to use in their liturgical settings for thinking about the Trinitarian persons, she also wants to rethink notions of power, okay, about God's power. So my next slide is going to be a little bit about divine power. But before I go to that, how do you often think about God's power? What does that mean to you? What do you associate with God's power? I'm sure there's a huge diversity of answers in the room. And I'm sure that, at least for me, I think about God's power as it's often imaged in the tradition, and then God's power as what it means to me. And those aren't exactly the same thing. But what do you associate? Let's start first with typical notions of God's power. And again, this is a huge range. It's hard to ask the question.
Healing.
Healing, okay.
parting the Red Sea.
Okay, so.
Big power there, it's split the ocean.
A big guy in charge of nature who can intervene and do things?
Creation.
Miraculous, okay, creator, healer, miraculous intervener, kind of, okay?
Conqueror.
Conqueror, okay?
Lord and King.
Lord and King.
Omniscience.
Okay, all-knowing.
Creator of the universe.
Okay, creator of the universe.
Wrathful.
Wrathful.
I'm thinking about from the other class. It's God's will.
Mm-hmm.
God is the answer. God decides all.
Okay, so kind of the steerer.
The controlling God.
Right, the controlling steerer of the ship, sort of.
Right. Whatever happens,
of,
uh-huh. God knew and planned it.
Yes. Okay.
Or the judge.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Judge.
Well, sort of something I also think of wisdom, but in almost in a way of the Native American trickster image.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the story of the parables, I'm turning everything upside down, this sort of
mm-hmm.
very, really wise scene.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. Yeah, so a power to
see things as they are.
Right. Right, to see surprisingly the truth of things and reveal that somehow. Okay. And what notions of God's power have been either alienating for you or meaningful or to you? So how do you assess some of these notions of power that have come up in the room so far?
One that
again, a diversity of answers,
love.
I'm sure.
Did any of us talk about love?
Okay.
I'm
but
sure.
Even love.
We didn't
right.
say that. But when I think about God,
mm-hmm.
that's one of the things I think about.
Mm-hmm. But love means so many things, too.
Yes, it does.
Right, because there can be sort of a kind of fatherly love who punishes for your own good.
That's
sort
right.
Of thing,
that's
right. And there can be a different kind, a suffering love.
And understanding.
Rebecca, what was it?
Well, you were saying love has been disappointing.
Yeah, what either has really resonated with you, or what has alienated you about, or what have you kind of been troubled by with respect to thinking about or reflecting about God's power?
I think that the whole notion of God's will is, especially when it comes to cruel or improbable circumstances, you know, you have a disabled child, well, that's God's will.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is something that has really turned.
Okay, so the idea that God is in charge in such a detailed way that it becomes the cause of every last thing that happens, and therefore a rationalization of things in ways that seem to push up against the problem of evil or something. Okay, yeah.
In the conquering, in the parting of the Red Sea, when God takes sides,
mm-hmm.
right? It hit me that way.
Is that good or bad for you?
That,
for you, I mean.
That's negative to me, that God takes sides.
Okay. Okay, why?
I guess because I'm a Christian, I think God's there for everybody. But,
okay. And yet she is saying that God takes sides against the injustice toward women. Right? And God would take side against those who, you know, who fail to address issues of injustice in our world. So, yeah, interesting. I think a lot of people
agree with everything she said.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm saying,
I don't know what you meant. I'm saying, but what I want to put up there is that each of these traits or capacities or associations can have kind of compelling applications and troubling applications. I mean, so we might not want to just get rid of some of these ideas. Even the idea that things are God's will. I mean, are we ready? I mean, maybe some of us are. I'm not exactly, it kind of varies day to day for me. Are we ready to give up the idea that God is somehow the ruler of the universe, right? And which is a way of saying that everything does happen according to God's will. I mean, if God, I might want to image that differently, that God is always sustaining and bringing the world to God's perfect end. But that's not altogether different than the idea that God's the guy steering the ship.
Right.
right? So do we want to completely give up that idea, or is it just the ways in which it's applied in communities and in spirituality in the face of our experience that gets troubling? I don't know. I mean, again, there's no right answer here in terms of this is about sharing our own experiences.
My reaction to the taking sides thing is when it seems capricious or arbitrary,
okay,
or unjust from mm-hmm. some perspective that I may hold. That's what it seems like to me.
Good. Good. So I'm looking at the time, so I'm going to keep going. So I'm first going to talk about the ways in which Johnson tries to criticize the ways in which God's power has been construed or imagined in streams of Christian traditions, and then talk about how she's redefining God's power in ways that she also thinks cohere with tradition, but she thinks have been forgotten too often. Okay, so she talks about the God of classical theism. Okay, this word classical theism can mean all sorts of things for us for our sake today. Okay, this is a God. This is a conception of God who has certain kinds of divine attributes that were articulated in the context first of Christian theology's encounter with Greek philosophy and kind of articulating its doctrines of God with Hellenistic ideas of what it is to be true, what it is to be perfect, what it is to be powerful, what perfect being is, etc. Okay, so it's the classical theology of the early church in its philosophical mode. But it's also the philosophical theology of the modern period shaped by the Enlightenment, this intellectual movement that places paramount importance on reason and rationality and has an interest in the kind of the empirical world and the world of the mechanistic conception of the universe. Okay, so this God of classical theism thinks less about God in Trinitarian terms. It kind of thinks about the Godhead, like what it is to be a perfect being. And so to be a perfect being would be this, it refers to this supreme being who rules all things, this kind of one God who is a being, who's the ruler and creator of the universe. This supreme being creates and governs, but according to the perfection of what it would mean to be a God, that God is unrelated to and unaffected by the world. Okay, and why is that? So because in this kind of theological tradition, there's an idea that, and this is really important in early Christian theology, and again in the theology of Thomas Aquinas, that God is, it was called pure act or pure actuality. Okay, so the fullness of being. So God's nature is to be, and to be totally in action while kind of unmoved by any other. So the idea of God is like a first mover, or that actuality that sustains the universe at all times. Right? And insofar as, for example, suffering is a passive state in some sense because you're acted on by an outside force, that would imply that you don't have full omnipotent power. Right? So God has to be unaffected by the world and, in a sense, unrelated to the world because God's absolute power, right, and absolute purity as a foundation and governor and sustainer of the world has to be kind of unviolated and protected. And if it were mixed with that which is finite, it wouldn't be perfect and free and omnipotent. If that makes sense, you know, in a sort of a gut feeling sort of way. So there's a way in which God is unrelated to and unaffected by the world. Okay. So this theology then emphasizes divine transcendence, but it tends sometimes to think of God, especially in Enlightenment thought, as this kind of perfect being. So kind of like the big rational man in the sky, sort of, you know, who has these traits. What would it be to be perfect? It would be to be infinite. You know, not subject to the contingencies of temporal life, right? It would be to be existing from oneself, self-existent, independent, not from another, right? The source of all, the unoriginate source. Incorporeal, without a body, because a body is finite and kind of limits us, right? I mean, I don't believe all this, just explaining it. To be eternal, to be immutable, incapable of change, right? Impassible, incapable of suffering. Simple, not compound, right? Perfect, all-knowing, and all-powerful. So these are the ways in which the God of classical theism is often described. If you were to read kind of manuals of systematic theology and tradition, you'd get these sections on divine attributes. God is omnipotent, omniscient, pure act, etc., impassible, etc. Okay, so what notion of power In your own words, then, if you were to kind of what model of power do you see behind these traits, or behind this classical God? How would you describe it? Even if you were to kind of refer to human language, if you could just describe this as a mode of kind of metaphorically human power. What model of power is this?
King.
Okay, good. Sovereign power.
Yes. Yeah.
The power of a sovereign.
Or a machine.
A king, a monarch.
A machine.
Okay.
Centralized.
Good.
Here, and then you go to it. It comes to you. You go to it.
Uh-huh.
It's in a place.
Good.
Identifying.
So power would be defined as the ability to do whatever you want, maybe, right? And power as power over, akin to a sovereign. Okay. So yeah.
It also seems harsh to me.
Okay.
That creates and governs, but is unrelated to and unaffected by the world, seems potentially very harsh.
Mm-hmm.
And uncaring.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Oh, good. Yeah, hierarchical, this is downward flowing. It's a top-down model of power. And in that sense, it is akin to a monarch. And again, we remind ourselves that from the beginning of what I said, that the early church ruled out the idea of the Trinity as that the Trinitarian relations as akin to a monarchy, right? Recognizing that that genuine love and compassion among the Trinitarian persons would be mutual, right? But slips into this mode of hierarchy or monarchy, where we really think about, okay, we say God is a Trinity, but really we sort of think that the real God is the Father, and that real God has a Son. Oh, and there's that spirit thing, which is kind of amorphous. Right? We don't think of God as the Godhead, which is three in one. Okay? We think of God, the generic category, equals Father. But what we should think is God equals that relation, right? Yeah, and that is if we care about it. I don't know if we do. That is orthodoxy, right? I mean, so we have it on our side. That's radical, not to say that. But yet, when someone like Elizabeth Johnson puts this out there, she's seen as somehow radical. But okay,
well,
so
we know why she's radical, though.
Okay, say it.
We know why because that's to me. When I read that, I was thinking, oh, well, I know why she was. Her book was, you know, done off with by the church hierarchy is because she's opposing the hierarchy of the church. Mm-hmm. That is exactly why.
Well, and now I just remembered something from that chapter on Jesus Sophia. It really, she doesn't take on this cause at all because it would be the end of her career, but it really does raise the question of whether women can represent Jesus and therefore be priests. Right, so, and I can't remember how she got it. So this is a totally creative move on her part because it's like, it's, but she doesn't go that far as to say it, but you can see how if you spin that out, that there's no reason really that women couldn't be priests. So, good. Yeah. So it really is. It's taking on. It's confronting kind of the power structure of the authorities, even though it's completely in a very smart and faithful way, drawing on the riches of the tradition that all sorts of other theologians draw on as well. Okay, so she thinks of God's power as, she draws on mutuality. Okay, that's not the only way she talks about it, but we're just focusing on that. And here's how she defines mutuality earlier in the book, when she's just talking about, well, what do we mean when we talk about mutuality between persons? Okay, so let's just think about what we mean by this word mutuality before we think about what would it mean if we apply it to God. And here's a quote from her book that defines mutuality. So mutuality signifies a relation marked by equivalence between persons, a concomitant valuing, so and with that, a valuing of each other, a common regard marked by trust, respect, and affection, in contrast to competition, domination, or assertions of superiority. Because you can imagine that the power of the previous slide is kind of, it's obviously modeled on domination, as we've said. It's also kind of competitive, because only one person can be the sovereign, right? And then there's also a notion of perfection as implying this sovereign power. So it's superior. But so mutuality, equivalence between persons, a kind of reciprocal valuing of each other, trust, respect for each other, affection for each other. I just wanted to ask you, how do you describe, when you think of relationships of mutuality, how do you think of them? Do you have examples of relationships that you think are mutual in your life or in people's lives or among people? Are all relationships that are loving mutual? What does the word mutuality mean to you? How does it relate to things like independence, freedom, dependence. What do you associate with this word? Talk with your neighbor for a minute so you can, everyone can have a chance to hear their voice speak for just one. Literally for a minute. Just do some popcorn. What do you associate popcorn and pop out box? First, just think of it. Mutuality, what does it mean to you?
Choir.
All of you. Okay, mutuality. What do you associate with it? In human relations, what qualities does it have?
A lot of give and take.
Okay. That's, I like that.
Teamwork.
Okay, was that here? Teamwork. Okay, good. So working together. I like that too. I'm going to reserve my comments, but.
One of the things that you said were the dependent and independent. Mm-hmm. To me, it just says mutually dependent and mutually independent. That it's there's an ebb and flow to it. So it doesn't mean this equal sign, but that sometimes I'm dependent on you, sometimes you're
symbiotic. Good. So maybe interdependent. That's what came to mind when Sonia was speaking. Yeah, interdependent. And also, I like this with the teamwork and give and take, because that's nice. Because one of the things that actually, when I taught this book in one of the classes at Carleton, someone said a really smart comment by a woman, a student who had a lot of feminist sensibility, but she was worried about this notion of mutuality because she was thinking, well, is between God and humans, because she was worried that it, not because she was overly pious, she actually was kind of worried about the power implications of saying, well, two that aren't equal, can they be mutual? Is that suggesting there's an equality? And then we thought about, well, do I have a mutual relationship with my kids, for example? And I mean, on the one hand, she was worried, like, well, is that suggesting that your kid, that you should have this equal relationship with your kid that would place unfair kind of burdens on them somehow? No, but teamwork or working give and take or this dependence and that kind of suggests that each has their own contribution and role to play. There's a relationality there, but it's not equal. It's not an equal sign.
It's changing.
Okay.
Continually changing.
Okay.
But can you have mutual relationships that's also antagonistic? For instance, democracy decision making. Mm-hmm. We don't all just get together and come up with consensus. There's an antagonistic relationship which ideally would still contain trust, respect.
Okay.
Listening.
Okay, good. So maybe there's the respect there, but yeah. But it sounds like you want to make room for more
sparring.
Yeah, disagreement.
Yeah.
And truth telling that might get kind of tense, but that's still
truths,
part of mutuality. Okay.
Mutually, but antagonistically.
Other thoughts about mutuality? Do you think? Oh, go ahead.
Well, to me, it raises the question: if there is interdependence, or is God then dependent on us at times? And then what happens to the idea of an omniscient, omnipotent, God, if God is in fact dependent on us?
What do you think about that? Because one question is it appropriate? I mean, defining mutuality among humans or in community or in relationship is one task, which might not be easy, but seems kind of surmountable, right? But thinking about mutuality between God and persons, how do you feel about that? Is that exciting to you? Is it the truth of what God's relationship to us is? Is it troubling? Does it clash up against other values you have about God?
So the notion of free will comes to play here. We're all part of a system.
Okay.
And we've got the ability to make decisions, which we do when we exercise that ability, then we're influencing the creation.
Okay.
So yeah, I think it is true.
So God is dependent on us in some way. Okay.
I always view God as within us. I've always viewed God as within us and not hierarchically above us. And we're living out God in what we do every day or not do every day.
Okay.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
We think about evil in the world as well, and God as being the opposite of evil.
Mm-hmm.
And if we are to carry out God's will to overcome evil, does that not imply mutuality with God?
It seems that we are responsible. We can't just say, well, God will take care of it, that we have to also be part of the process.
Okay. So here again, it may not be an equal sign between God and humans, but there may still be a working together that's called for or that's evoked from God's word to us. We're called to that co-participation somehow, even though it may not be an equal. Is that what you're thinking? Or? Okay.
There are senior partners too.
Right. So mutuality. So she tries to model God's power on mutuality. And so one of the ways that she thinks she has a resource for this, as I've already mentioned, is that she thinks that the doctrine of the Trinity, when properly understood, is a good model for mutuality, and that the Trinitarian persons are marked by relationality as the very stuff of their being. The essence of God is to be relational. That again, these are non-hierarchical relations, but also the dynamism, the internal dynamism of the Trinity when it's kind of active in the world, is an outpouring of that loving relationality and compassion. Okay, so this is one of the and so this here, she then calls into question the classical demand that God be incapable of suffering. Right? Because even when, for example, when the kind of orthodox doctrine was articulated about Jesus' death, is that Jesus suffered in his person, but not in his divinity. Right. So there's a very strong weight in the tradition to avoid saying that God suffers, because this really does seem to kind of compromise the very notion of what it is to be God, and also the ability of God to save the world, or to bring about salvation. If God can suffer, then God can be defeated. Then how can God be relied upon in times of suffering and to bring about ultimate salvation? Ultimate, not necessarily otherworldly, but to kind of bring forth God's redemption even on earth. So it is a tricky, tricky issue, I think. And so Johnson then suggests that God suffers as a free act. This is where she tries to preserve some notion of God's otherness. Because remember, what is one of her major commitments? Divine incomprehensibility. So she doesn't want to bring God's mystery and transcendence completely down to something utterly finite, right? In full, she wants to preserve that God is. She talks about God is in the world and the world is in God. So there is some of the resonance with what some people in the room have been saying. But God is also more than the world. So she doesn't want to collapse God into that which is finite. So God suffers as a free act. Preserving divine freedom. And yet there's this interdependence because God's suffering kind of with people. Engaged in as a consequence of care for others. So God's outpouring compassion and love is so devoted, right, that it does therefore demand that God be capable of suffering. And here she does depart from, again, the dominant trend of kind of elite theology in the tradition. And so what she says that God's suffering does is that what God's sufferings mean is that when people who are suffering feel that God is suffering with them, it on the one hand awakens a sense of consolation that God is present in suffering, that God knows suffering, and that God is accompanying one in one's suffering. Okay? She also then thinks it has an ethical dimension. It kind of awakens people to responsible human action, to say, well, if God is suffering with me and God suffers when those who suffer suffer, then we better get busy working for justice and changing our world. Right? And this is similar to what we talked about with James Cone in Black Liberation Theology, that to be at the site of revelation is to sort of put one's body with, at his time, African Americans who were suffering and put yourself in the line of fire. That's where you encounter revelation. That's where you become black with God you take on that potential suffering and risk precisely as an expression of kind of changing the world and transforming the world and working for redemption with God's purposes. And then she also thinks that God's suffering can offer hope in the sense that if God knows that one trusts somehow mysteriously that in that capacity of God to suffer, God also has the capacity to transform, and that there is a hope beyond suffering. This part, I guess I want to leave you with a sort of as a little food for thought, and then we'll end with just a little reading from scripture. I'd invite you to continue kind of meditating on this notion of God's suffering and God's weakness, because there are other voices within the tradition, even among liberation theologians, who say, well, if you take it that far, then do you undercut God's ability to really be a strong source of power against situations of mass suffering and mass oppression? How can, if God suffers, and God is not apart from the world, and God's not in control of the world, then what kind of hope does one have that there's any power out there that's capable of ending that kind of suffering? Right? So does this somehow undercut God's suffering? Or is this precisely what makes God's power compelling and capable of addressing suffering? Those are the kinds of questions I want to raise up. So some theologians along in a sort of a different strand of thinking, but with a lot of resonance with Elizabeth Johnson, have started to think about God as weak, as a kind of radical and subversive way of talking about God. So that's one of the reasons I chose to talk about the weakness of God. And so thinking of God as weak, although it raises these puzzles and questions that I was just articulating, it also is a creative tool for providing a corrective to our normal expectations about what God's power looks like, or our dominant expectations of what God's power looks like. It interrupts ideas of God as an unlimited power, as a dominator, right? And it conjures up kind of an idea of a God who in a way disrupts, almost in an anarchic way, right? God's weakness interrupts situations of dominating power and shows you something else, okay? So God then becomes the name of this call, that weak force that's calling you into some other model of power or model of agency. And God's not this kind of heavy-handed causality that's bringing about his purposes in the world, right? So with that, I thought it would be appropriate to end just briefly with 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 25. For the foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than human strength. Thank you. Thank you.